Could everybody just pop into the Q&A and just send some love to Dr. Pimentel? That would be amazing. I think it's a huge, huge, huge development here, guys. It is so powerful. And I'm totally thrilled and humbled to be able to help facilitate getting this information out. I know you guys are working like 24/7, Dr. Pimentel. So please send your team our love and gratitude. Big time. Okay, so a couple of questions that I know are in this huge list. And Karen, can you grab the time so we can just tell Miles so he knows how to edit this? Thank you. So what's the name of the test and how can we get it? And Mariel, can you pop the link from SIBO SOS, our website, into the chat so that people can click on it easily? So let's just talk about IBS Smart Test for a few minutes, if we could.
Sure. So I helped found the company, so I'll give you that as a disclosure, because I wanted to guide the science. I wanted to make sure that this was patient-centered and not company-centered. So I've done things differently this time, but more importantly, it's a second-generation test, and it's more specific. We figured out some of the quirks of the test. And again, greater than 90%, but it's IBS Smart, and it's at www.ibssmart.com, and you can order the test that way. But your doctor really has to order the test, because we want to make sure that the doctor, that it's covered by your insurance for the most part, so that you don't have to pay for it, because that's not fair.
And even if your insurance doesn't pay for it, it's not overly expensive if you do need to do cash. And I think there's a link there on the IBS Smart Test website where even the lab will reach out to your doctor and solicit that prescription. So it's very organized, very professional. So I want you guys to be aware of that. Right? I mean, they have their act together big time. They're great.
Yeah. Okay. So, I mean, it basically, it's all of that. There's a portal for the doctor to order kits. They have to draw the blood in their office. And then there's a portal for patients to say, well, how can I get it? And how can my doctors, or you can tell your name of your doctor and we'll reach out and the team will reach out. But the point is, we're trying to stop the ridiculous expenses and things that patients go through, and that always irritate me, because I think patients are just getting over-tested, honestly.
Markel is saying fabulous cutting edge information. It's helped clarify some questions that you've had with some of her difficult patients. Fantastic. When is SIN? Is it SIN 010 or SIN 10? When's that going to be available?
So the trial's on now. So things are finally moving. We were in quicksand for a long time, but I think we're getting to the right place. I'm very excited. I know the patients are super excited to get in. We still have a lot of room in the trial. So if anybody lives in the LA area and your methane, please share this information. We're happy to recruit more patients. We have to get to 150 very quickly in a few months, so we're getting there.
Okay, so how would they reach out to you guys in order to participate or be a candidate for participation?
They could, I have to get the mast email. I'll have somebody pull that from the other room and just pass a message to me.
Okay.
So that I can give it to you later.
Okay, and then the other question is, they take the IBS Smart Test, they get results, they show that they're positive. Is right. It more likely that they're methane or that they're hydrogen?
Yeah, so this has confused a lot of people, but let me sort of, I use it all the time in my clinic, and I'm going to explain how I use it. So it's sort of like you have a heart condition. You're having a heart attack. You have an EKG, and the EKG says you're having a heart attack. And then you do an ultrasound of the heart to look at the function of the heart to get more definition of what you're going to do. So maybe you have heart failure and you have to use these medications. EKG doesn't tell you to use heart failure meds. It only tells you that you are having a heart attack or there's heart dysfunction. So it's the same thing here, but the blood test tells you you had food poisoning. Let me give you the best example possible. So I had a patient, was positive on the blood test, treated with rifaximin for her IBS. She's amazing. She feels terrific. She says, I'm going to Costa Rica. What should I do? And I said, you've got to do something. So she goes to Costa Rica, but I give her, and this is off-label use, half a pill of Rifaximin with every meal, because I don't want her to get food poisoning again, because she already has the antibodies. So she goes to Costa Rica with this wedding party or whatever, a group of 20 people, and they're touring the country on a bus, going to the volcano, etc. But the bus is stopping at every restroom because 19 people on that bus have diarrhea, except for my patient, who's the IBS patient. She was perfect the whole time. Point being, the IBS patient was the healthiest person on the trip. No offense to people from Costa Rica. Love that country, been there. Somebody just ate some bad food there, and that was how that happened. But 20 people, 19 people sick, the only person not sick, my patient. So it's just an example of how I use the antibody. But I also tell people who have positive antibodies, look, make smart choices with food. You can't avoid food poisoning because who knows, it could be from, you know, your grocery store, some recall. But chances are, if you cook at home, you're not going to get it. Chances are, if you eat at a restaurant that has an A on the door, you're less likely to get it than if you eat at a restaurant with a C on the door, reputable places. That's all I'm saying is be more cautious, and people do. And I have patients, my final comment is, I have patients who, using the first generation test, rolling into the second generation test, where because of my advice, no food poisoning, and their conscious choices, the antibodies have declined to the point where they don't feel like their IBS is a big problem anymore, no more drugs. And so I know that if we keep the food poisoning away long enough, the antibodies will drift down.
Okay, cool. So if you think you're having food poisoning, try to use Rifaximin. Obviously, speak with your doctor. This isn't medical advice, you guys. This is just some ideas.
Right. So what you're saying is a slightly different scenario. I was using it as prevention, but Rifaximin is approved, FDA approved, for food poisoning. So if you have food poisoning right now, it's FDA approved to take it. And the shorter the food poisoning, the less likely those antibodies are to rise up. So again, that's very meaningful, very important. Get on it. Don't wait.
And remember, one person's food poisoning is another person's gastritis, I've observed. People are like, oh, I've never had food poisoning, right? What do you say to that, Dr. Pimentel?
Well, so some people say, well, I don't remember food poisoning, and you're telling me food poisoning caused my IBS, but the patient's in the office with diarrhea. I said, well, what was your first day of diarrhea like? Well, I don't remember. Well, the first day of diarrhea could have been just a mild diarrhea. You had to start at some point, and maybe that was food poisoning. You just don't remember. You know, the people who remember are if their honeymoon was ruined on a vacation, or they were in the hospital in a foreign country. Obviously, those are very, you know, they stick in your head. But just the test is very sound in terms of diagnosing that for you.
Okay. And also, I went to a place called Any Lab Test Now, and they drew my blood and sent it in. So it isn't just about having to go to the doctor's office. We're going to keep going, you guys. I'm going to kind of pop around. I'm going to do my best. I will say your first name associated with your question. So when you get the PDF at home, you can search by your first name. So there are a couple of people, though, that I've combined your questions. And this is general for Amy, Susan, Liz, Paris 2, Ellen, Lorraine, Kim. Dr. Pimentel, probiotics or no probiotics with SIBO?
So this is a complicated answer because I get sometimes criticism for my lack of enthusiasm around probiotics. But I want to be very, very clear. I do not have lack of enthusiasm around probiotics. I have lack of enthusiasm around the lack of enthusiasm by probiotic companies to put money down and do the proper clinical trials. And so show me a trial that has 200 people per arm. I don't want a massive trial, just 200 people per arm that shows that it works in SIBO, and I will use that probiotic all day, all night. That's my point. So it's the problem is we have small little trials that aren't very well controlled, a lot of anecdote. There are probiotics, Bifido, for example, that triggers migrating motor complex. Does it trigger it in SIBO? Never been studied. Does it cause more bloating, even though it's triggering I don't know, never been studied. What we do know is the Placide study of 3,000 patients, the only benefit you got from that specific probiotic was bloating if you took the probiotic. So I've not seen tremendous results with probiotics in my clinic, except for anecdotes. So I do have some patients where they do get better. So I don't know if that's a good answer, but that's sort of where I'm at.
So Kim is asking about the Bifidobacterium lactis HN019. Are you familiar with these strains?
Right, exactly. So yeah. If you go to your store, General Nutrition Center or this, you see a wall of probiotics. Some are in the fridge. Some cost $80. Some cost $10. Is the 80 better than the 10? My point is not against probiotics. I think probiotics are a future of this and a potential future therapy, but we need to figure it out. And I need better data. I'd be happy to study some of these, but I haven't been given many offers of, you know, funding for doing that. So that's the point. And I do see some patients get worse. I do see some patients get better, but it's purely anecdotal and I haven't seen anything consistent.
Okay. So Lorraine, I'm not going to totally get to your question because I think he just answered it, is that there have been no studies to show that crowding out good or bad bacteria from taking probiotics can impact you long-term for your SIBO. So it needs to be studied is the bottom
line.
There
is one meta-analysis in SIBO, but they combined a bunch of little tiny trials, and that combination of trials in and of themselves weren't very powerful. So somebody might quote that to me and say that, well, did you know about this? Yes, I do. But the problem with some meta-analyses is that they take all negative trials and all of a sudden you get a positive trial. And again, my point is, I think has great potential, but I'd like to see more data. That's all.
Okay. And I love that you're saying that could be the future of it too. So
absolutely.
So we just did a masterclass with Jason Horlack, which was so interesting. And was talking a lot about strains and studies and it's the Wild West. Yeah, lots to learn.
But there are strains. I mean, it may be very strain specific, and that's your Lorraine's question. I guess that was her name, Lorraine.
Yeah. Yep.
It's very important, but yeah. I'd like to see the data around it and to be sure. And I don't want to cause any trouble for my patients. Let me tell you, the ultimate probiotic, fecal transplant in IBS, caused harm. So placebo was superior statistically than fecal transplant in most of those very big relatively big double blind studies, four trials. So that's the ultimate probiotic. Now some may argue that's not a good probiotic, but that is the ultimate probiotic and it was harmful, not helpful.
Okay. What do you think about people who keep getting negative SIBO breath tests but still have symptoms?
It's negative breath test but still has symptoms. So this is a really important, because this is where we think hydrogen sulfide is going to be important. Because a flatline breath test, even a marginal elevated breath test that may be called negative or called borderline, it's probably because hydrogen sulfide is there, especially on the diarrhea side. But even some of the constipated, we in the trial saw some patients who had both methane and hydrogen sulfide. And we think it's going to dictate the therapy. But I honestly can't tell you. People are going to ask me, well, what do you use for hydrogen sulfide? First of all, that was a clinical trial, but it wasn't a treatment trial. So we don't have enough experience with the gas to be able to tell you what treatment works best. But we will have that within the next, you know, few months.
Oh, that's huge. That's huge. I thought you were going to say the next few years.
By the end of the year, we will at least in our clinic have tried various things and have a sense anecdotally, but of course then we'll go on to clinical trials and try and prove all of that.
So that was for Marie and Christy and Tamara and Esther and Taza and Alexander. So then there's a lot of confusion around, okay, I have hydrogen, but I'm constipated, and normally that's associated with diarrhea. I have methane, but I have diarrhea. So there's all this like, well, I have this on the test, but my symptoms are opposite of what is usual based on what they've
been. That's exactly why hydrogen sulfide is so important, because we showed in the study, which will come out in the paper, and we presented at the meeting, so it's public information, is that it's a tug of war between hydrogen sulfide and methane. And one of them is in every patient, one of them wins the war because they're warring for hydrogen. You know, it's just like you have a lake and you have two groups of people who are separate cities trying to eat the fish out of the lake. And whichever one gets the most fish is more prominent and so forth. And so in the individual where they have methane, but they have diarrhea, it could be that their hydrogen sulfide's through the roof and hydrogen sulfide is winning in that patient, even though they have a little bit of methane there. So that's the sort of the information we're going to get once the new test is available.
And then is the treatment for the hydrogen sulfide the same as for hydrogen and methane? You knew I was going to ask you this.
Yes. And I sort of expressed that by the end of the year, we're going to have an idea on treatment. Okay. I think we're going to get there. Yep.
Okay, cool. Do you have an opinion from Sandra about which microbiome test is best? And do you see a value in that? Speaking of overtesting.
Well, so I wasn't making that point in when I gave sort of the lecture part of it, but what I said in the lecture makes the point, is that the stool microbiome reflects nothing of the small bowel. And the small bowel really needs to be identified. And so nobody actually has a commercial test for measuring small bowel microbiome yet. We're one of the only places in the world that's doing this in-depth analysis and setting the standard on how to do it. But so that's the problem, is that you amplify a lot of things that are dead, a lot of things that have, let's think about it this way, just, and I know this is really, really gross, but I'm a gastroenterologist, so for me, it's like dinner conversation. Think of a piece of stool, right? It's like a cylinder. The coating or the outside of the stool is the only thing that you see as a human, because the bugs on the outside are producing things that maybe you get absorbed. But everything else on the inside, it's just between them because it doesn't escape the solid material. So the point is, the majority of the bugs you're amplifying are dead. The majority of what you amplify is on the inside of the stool, which isn't even relevant to you. So it means that it's a whole warm mess, so to speak.
Let's move on. I got it. Okay. So, Karen and Marcia and Joanne and Anna, your information, your answers are in previous masterclass and Q&A recordings with Dr. Pimentel. So I'm going to keep going here. Heartburn, Dr. Pimentel. Stephanie, what is the best way to handle acid reflux when you're also trying to cure very stubborn SIBO, since it seems reflux meds are counterproductive to SIBO clearing, besides just avoiding acidic foods, since I'm desperate to have a less restrictive diet? Yeah.
So should we just cover diet in general?
Yeah, sure. Let's cover diet in general, and then we have to cover like acid.
And, yeah. Okay. Yeah. So let's do acid then specifically, because okay. I'm sure there'll be other questions. So acid's complicated because you need acid to help digest food. So there are some who say, well, you should take apple cider vinegar or other things, because you take those things and that acid will help kill bacteria. That's absolutely true. So exposure to acid, like the acid in the stomach for a very brief period of time, kills bacteria. Then you take medications that suppress acid, like PPI. Yes, that suppresses acid. And as a result of that, you can get some buildup of bacteria. The problem with that is even PPIs don't have 24-hour coverage. They say 24-hour coverage, but what they mean is that for almost all of 24 hours, but even 5 minutes of the potent acidity in the stomach, boom, the bacteria are gone, because acid is very, very harsh. And so we don't see as much overgrowth as we would have expected just from acid. But yes, it does happen. But the question is, should you avoid acid? Should you add acid? And this is really important for methane. So in the study we did with PPIs, there was no more overgrowth with PPIs in IBS patients than those who didn't take PPIs. But what we did see is those with PPIs had less methane. So acid is hydrogen. It's an ion of hydrogen, but it's hydrogen, and the methanogens use acid to make methane. So if you add acid, you fuel methane. If you take away acid, you reduce the fuel of methane production. So in people with methane, I would suggest actually low acid diet. In people with hydrogen or non-methane, it's complicated because I don't know what the hydrogen sulfide is, because hydrogen sulfide also would use acid. So it's complicated.
Okay.
So knowing the breath test may tell you whether you should or should not do acid. If you're only hydrogen, acid's fine. If you're methane, try to avoid it.
Oh, really interesting. Okay. I wanted to let everybody know, anybody who is listening to this because you've recently purchased this class, you will in your portal also have the last masterclass and Q&As that we've done with Dr. Pimentel, because I know there's no way for us to answer everybody's question in today's session, and I didn't want you all to be disappointed. I wanted you to have this information. So when you go and you log into your portal, it's all there. So that's why I'm skipping some of your names. And actually, I'm not doing the greatest job of saying your name with your question, but you'll get the transcript, so you'll be able to scour through all of this as well. Okay. Let me just get to, what was the, oh, the diet. Let's talk about diet. That was the other thing. So everybody wants to know about low fermentation diet while they're taking the medicines, the rifaximin or the herbals to kill. And by the way, just help us to finally once and for all discuss low FODMAP long-term or not.
Okay.
Thanks.
So people listen to me really, really carefully. And sometimes they listen to me too carefully. And sometimes my words get extrapolated. And I don't mean for that to be the case, because words can be black and white, even text can be black and white, but then there's more to the story. And I think in diet, that's the case. So generally speaking, what I believe is that if you restrict calories, this is not belief, this is old science from microbiology years, where if you restrict calories to bacteria, they go into hibernation. Some of them form spores, some of them wall themselves off to protect themselves from the environment and sort of brace themselves for a famine or dry times and so or lean times. And so restricting calories means, and bugs tend to be more resistant to antibiotics. That's true. That's very well known. So my philosophy is, don't restrict calories to bacteria. Don't be on these low fermentation, low FODMAP diets if you are treating with rifaximin. What ended up happening is people said, well, maybe what he means is feed them. And so people are doing guar gum and all these sorts of things I hear through the blogs and the internet that people are suggesting maybe to augment. To be truthful, I don't do that. I don't augment, but I also can't say that isn't a good thing. I don't know. Maybe it is. Maybe it does help augment the effect of antibiotics. So you could be right, but that wasn't what I said, and that isn't what I do. Now, in terms of the low fermentation versus low FODMAP, we use the low fermentation diet, something we created here in like 2003, 2004, long before low FODMAP became hyped. We didn't write a book about it, so it didn't get hyped as much. But low FODMAP, to be fair, has done a lot of science, which is really good. A lot of double-blind studies and careful research. So it's a legitimate diet. But the problem with the low FODMAP diet is it's highly restrictive. And so what happens is there's two negative things that have been found with the low FODMAP diet, three negative things. Number one, you tend to lose weight. For some people, they like that part of it, but it means that there's some lack of nutrition in it. The second is that Bill Che from Ann Arbor has shown that after 3 months of low FODMAP, you actually can measure in the blood some nutritional deficiencies. So that's the point why low FODMAP diet you need to start reintroducing at some point so that you don't get the nutritional deficiencies. The third is microbial diversity. All we talk about at the microbiome conferences is more diversity, better biome. More diversity, better biome. So your biome is improved if it's diverse. But low FODMAP diet has been shown to cause a severe reduction in diversity. So does that put you at risk for infections? Does that put you at risk for inflammatory bowel diseases? Nobody has proven that yet, but we have shown, or not us, but others have shown, that that's another downside of the low FODMAP diet. The low fermentation diet is much more liberal. It's more meant to be balanced. It's meant that you could go to a restaurant, you could probably find something on the menu that is low fermentation without asking the waiter too many. In my mind, I picture the patients all the time as front and center. They go to a restaurant, how irritating it is for the patient to be able to say to the waiter, well, does it have this? Does it have this? Does it have this? Does it? Meanwhile, the rest of the company of that person is saying, wow, they're, you know, judging them on their selection. So I'd like a person to go into a restaurant, find something, and not have to talk too much to the waiter, because that's a better lifestyle and social experience for them. So I'm trying to make the patients as normal as possible so they don't have to feel like a burden.
Good. Sounds good. GERD. We just need some clarity about GERD. 2 PPI or not 2 PPI? That was the question. And GERD is placebo.
Yeah. I mean, if you have GERD, GERD is a risk factor for esophageal cancer in the long run. So you have to treat GERD. So I'm going to just state that outright. You have to treat it in some way, shape, or form. PPI, we didn't find that it causes higher hydrogen in people with IBS. But in healthy people who have just plain old GERD, we do see some overgrowth developing that they didn't have before. So I don't hesitate to use GERD treatments, but I don't use PPI as a treatment for methane. Now, my data suggests I could. If I put methane people on a PPI, the methane wouldn't go away, but it would go down. And so you could theoretically do that. It's not indicated for that, but I haven't routinely done so. But that's the other part of the PPI story.
Interesting. This has to do with iron. Have you noticed the correlation between people with SIBO and low iron?
Well, so there, with very bad SIBO, there's a couple of things that happen. B12 can go down, iron can go down, but folate tends to go up. So one of the markers for SIBO is a high folate, because bacteria produce folate. We don't make folate, so we use the bacteria of our gut to help make it for us. So that's where we get our folate from.
So if somebody's iron is low and you give them iron or like an IV drip of iron, do you think that it will make their SIBO symptoms worse or make their SIBO test positive, more positive?
So iron isn't necessarily a growth factor for bacteria in the way that, so we call them, cause them to bloom or blossom. But the other caution about iron, first of all, iron therapies are very expensive, especially infusions, but the other part about iron is iron can also be deficient because you have a tumor leaking blood in your gut. So when we see low iron, we're more likely to scope somebody, and it's an appropriate scope because we're looking for something more sinister. So just be careful that it isn't, or even inflammation can cause bleeding. Something could be leaking blood in the gut, and that's also very important if the iron is low. So that's what we call a red flag, and we have to be cautious.
Perfect. Okay. So this just has to do with treatment for methane, because we haven't really talked about it in a sort of in a capsule moment here, but a lot of people are wondering about Julie. Can you recommend another antibiotic protocol for methane dominant SIBO besides the rifaximin neomycin, the rifaximin clindamycin, the rifaximin flagyl? She's unable to handle the side effects from the second line of antibiotics.
Yeah, so first of all, the published paper, still off-label because it isn't FDA approved for that, is rifaximin neomycin. We've had good success with rifaximin metronidazole. We have not used, in our clinic, clindamycin with rifaximin, but it sounds like her physician has. So honestly, at that point, we do use some of the naturals. We do use now I'm blanking on it, but the commercial name is Alimed, the garlic.
Allison.
And we do use that, and it does provide a reduction in methane and temporary relief for some patients, although that wears off over time. we do try some of those in those patients, but we're holding out the best optimism for the SYN-10 trial. And of course, if she wants to participate, she lives close to Los Angeles, that might work too.
We'll get you that contact information, everybody. Everybody's already asking about that. Okay. Now, if you have the methane and hydrogen SIBO together, Barb is wondering, what's your usual treatment program for that?
Methane and SIBO, I start with rifaximin plus neomycin in the off-label use for 14 days. They have to take the correct dose, 550 three times a day of rifaximin, 500 twice a day with neomycin, and do that for the full 14 days. What we noticed is that it's between day 10 and 14 that you get the best effect for reasons we don't understand with the bug. So you have to do the full 14, and compliance is super important. So you have to take all the pills, and it's a pain because there's a lot, but that's the only way to get it better. So that's what I start with. Of course, if it works, I still use a prokinetic after, because methane, we want to try and keep it away as much as possible. We do use the low fermentation diet with maybe some caveats of reducing acid in the diet, because I think that's important for methane. And you know, some people can go a couple of months, but it tends to come back more quickly. But that's what I do as sort of the starting point.
Okay. Now, if someone has methane and hydrogen, same thing?
If they're constipated and any methane there, yes. So
that's where the symptom on top of the test result.
That's right. Exactly. Okay.
Great. And again, the reason I know that is because he has talked about that in the previous classes, which you have in your portal. Let's see. These questions just kind of blew me away, you guys. You're so smart. Christina, regarding the article, susceptibility of archaea to antimicrobial agents, applications to clinical microbiology in the Journal of Clinical Microbiology and Infection, why are squalamine and fusidic acid not commonly used treatments for methane SIBO? That is an advanced question.
That is an advanced question. Mm-hmm. So we are looking at a number of therapies, and I can't tell you we haven't looked at squalamine, because of course we have, and that paper is familiar to me. We've had such good success with so in the first lovastatin trial, going back to the SYN-10, we saw that blocking the methane synthesis isn't an antibiotic, okay? What it's doing is it's impairing the bug's ability to produce energy. As a result, it doesn't replicate as much. And so the bacteria that are around it say, hey, the methanogens are like not working so well. So they fill in where the methanogens were. And that sort of causes the shift. And then after 3 months, we have patients where the methane disappeared from the lovastatin. And even now, they're still back to normal. So we think a new world order in the colon or in the gut occurs from lovastatin. So there's a lot of options we could have taken, and your viewer is very, very well educated on this topic, but we chose the lovastatin road, and so now we're sort of stuck in that road. But yes, I am familiar with the paper.
So I just want to talk about underlying causes for a second, because people are saying, well, if I take rifaximin and it only works for 3 months or less, what's the benefit? You know, they're like, I took the drug and then it got better short term, and then it didn't work anymore, or I relapsed. So we're obviously talking about post-infectious IBS as one of the underlying causes. But if you have like diverticulitis, or you have blind loops, or you have adhesions, just what's a strategy for everybody else?
Well, and every strategy is different. If you have adhesions, like I give an example of somebody that I saw who was very distended, got rifaximin, felt great. 1 week later, it's back. Got rifaximin, felt great. 1 week later, it's back. And this person had never in their whole life had surgery. Never had any complication of anything. And so I did a barium study to look for an adhesion. Sure enough, she had a sling around her ileum, just pulling the ileum down into the right lower quadrant, angulating the ileum, and there was an adhesion there. The surgeon thought I was crazy because the patient was just miserable with this distension. Surgeon thought I was crazy that she would have an adhesion from nothing, never having had surgery in the past. He called me after the procedure. He says, I've never seen anything like it. There was literally a sling. It took me 1 second. I cut it and everything returned to its normal place. And he said, it was absolutely amazing to see this. The patient hasn't seen me in years now, has been doing really well. But treat the adhesion if you can. The problem is if the adhesions are, you know, fixing adhesions, get more adhesions in some patients. And so you can be on a very vicious cycle where you're doing surgery after surgery after surgery. I feel bad for those patients because some of those patients need to be on chronic therapy, chronic antibiotics. And I do have some patients on chronic antibiotics because of that. But there's no miracle cure for adhesions, not yet. And that's not one we're working on because it's a very difficult thing to solve.
I'm going to be interviewing Heidi Peterson in Portland, and she does some things that are pretty naturopathic and neuro injections, and then there's Clear Passage and Clear Passage is in Gainesville, Florida. So a lot of people are trying a lot of things, which is exciting to try to deal with adhesions.
And I have used Clear Passage for some of my adhesion patients where I just don't want to do more surgery, but I guess my putting my science hat on again is the reason adhesions grow with time is because you're pulling and tearing and pulling and tearing and more scar tissue forms. If we push and tear more, do we create more? I don't know. I'm trying to wrestle with it, but I do see some patients where with visceral manipulation, they feel better temporarily and then they got to go back. But that same patient that had such a great benefit now has been in and out of the hospital with more adhesions. And so who knows? I mean, but obviously they're desperate. They need something.
Yeah. It has visceral manipulation has helped me. I'm hoping that it sticks. Okay. We're going to keep going here. What about brain fog? Anika is wondering about brain fog and treatment. Do you see that direct correlation between IBS, SIBO, and brain fog?
So we see a lot of brain fog and often in methane producers, we see a lot more brain fog, and getting the bacteria or the archaea down in the instance of methane definitely helps brain fog. Satish Rao has a very nice set of papers that are coming out, and he presented some work on even lactic acidosis from bacteria. But brain fog really is something we described in the book in 2006, even, that brain fog really kind of disappeared when the bacteria went down, and patients really noticed that. I ask that question less often these days. I'm not sure why. I really should get back on it.
With the rifaximin, doesn't it also have a benefit for that liver condition, like the ammonia and the liver?
Yeah, so rifaximin is used for hepatic encephalopathy, which is a condition where the liver is failing and you're cirrhotic. And basically the bacteria of the gut are accumulating and producing toxins. Now the liver can't get rid of it because the liver is not working anymore. And so those toxins overflow and ammonia goes up as a byproduct. But the rifaximin, what it does is it decreases the bacteria of the gut. And as a result, it decreases those toxins and the chemicals. And that helps the brain fog of the extreme, which is hepatic encephalopathy.
Okay, perfect. Let's see here. What is your experience with Atron Teal, that supplement that Dr. Ken Brown has created?
You know, I've had some evolution of thinking around it. I mean, Dr. Ken Brown has, his product has done quite well. And it seems to be that there is some effect in methane, or at least people are describing that. I haven't tested it formally in that way. But certainly some patients do respond in terms of the bloating, especially with Atron Teal as a combination of herbs that seems to affect the microbe in some way. I'd love to study it more formally and maybe try and understand what's happening in the small bowel as a result. But I think there's something there. I don't understand it all, and it doesn't work for everybody, but I think there's something interesting there.
Carlene, do you have a theory, Dr. Pimentel, on why some patients have are methane producers or have methane producers in their gut? Do you think it's genetics?
To be honest, I don't think it's genetic. I think it's environmental. So we often see if mom has methane, daughter and son have methane. You know, look, your mother, your father are caring for you all their life. You're exposed to them. and their microbes, and you're exposed to the food that they cook with their hands, and you know, we're not always perfectly clean. And so we share our organisms. So where our organisms are, is a very funny study that sort of speaks to this, is that people with dogs have more of a dog microbiome because the dog's constantly licking their face. It's the same thing with humans. We're all living together, exposed to the same thing. But I do see that if mom has methane, daughter has methane, and I have a lot of mother-daughter, mother-son, father-son kind of patients in the clinic.
Dorothy, if anti-vinculin antibodies are negative, should one still test for the anti-CDTB antibodies?
So it's just, it's a panel, so you get both. So
okay.
Automatic.
And didn't you say that the anti-CDTB is what happens when it's a little bit more acute, so those will eventually go down and the anti-vinculin will go up?
Correct. Correct. You learned. You see, you were listening.
I'm so proud of myself. Okay. I'm a patient just like you guys, right? Okay. Is there any relationship between the archaea and methane gas production and ammonia in the gut or the bloodstream? Circling back to that rifaximin liver connection.
Oh, specifically bacteria in the gut equals ammonia?
Yeah.
Interesting. It's a little complicated there, because if you talk to the liver doctors, they say that the amount of ammonia in the bloodstream is not proportional to the degree of confusion or brain fog. So they don't treat the ammonia. They basically just empirically treat, and then the ammonia comes down concomitantly. So it could be that ammonia is really a surrogate of a particular group of organisms, and those organisms simply represent the fact that there are too many organisms around, but they haven't been able to say high ammonia equals brain fog, low ammonia equals no brain fog. That science has been studied immensely, and those connections are not linear. So there's not a line drawn between those two key factors. So sorry, that's a bit of a vague answer, but that's the facts.
Taza, Susan, your post-infectious IBS questions we have answered here. Okay, Pam, how do I know if I should do the IBS smart test? If I already know that I have IBS, do I need it? And then if I am positive, what would I do as a result? That's a good question.
Well, so people come in the office and they have constipation, for example, and they said, like, the IBS smart test. And I say, look, you know, the constipation category, it's not as valuable. So I say, I think it's probably not worth, look, if you want to spend the money, fine, but it's not really worth it as much as if you're on the diarrhea or mixed side. So, but what I tell my patients is, look, if you want to know where your IBS came from, meaning it's from food poisoning, and you want me to guide you on, okay, if this is positive, you need to avoid food poisoning, and this is why. But also, let's say a patient comes to my office and they have IBS, then they get food poisoning, and now they're way worse. I don't have a marker to tell me that they're way worse. So if I had that baseline marker and they got food poisoning again, and now their IBS is way worse, I'm going to measure it again. I'm going to say, look, this is what happened because of the food poisoning. You got to be more careful. So it guides me. In the end, it's going to guide therapy. And that's what I'm excited about. But if you're in the beginning of your IBS journey, this can diagnose your IBS instantly, well, quickly. So that's even valuable. But I use it in all my patients where it's D or mixed at this point, because I need to counsel them about food poisoning.
Gotcha. So Rick, are there other conditions besides food poisoning, particularly autoimmune, that could cause elevated anti-vinculin levels with the IBS smart test? I know Gemelli Biotech has developed a scleroderma test that seems to rely on anti-vinculin antibodies. If so, would treatment just be prokinetics or other?
So the vinculin story with scleroderma, so I'm going to tell you some new stuff, but it's very hypothesis. But the patients with scleroderma have very high, like I mean very high, anti-vinculin. So IBS, in the sense of SIBO, is a neuropathy of the gut. But scleroderma is an autoimmune neuropathy of the gut and the skin of the body. And so we got the idea that, well, maybe scleroderma is you've had vinculin antibodies for 30 years at very high levels. Maybe it's important to the development of scleroderma. And sure enough, the test was important. Not important for lupus, not important for rheumatoid arthritis, but just specifically for scleroderma is what we saw. So then we did the validation, and it actually is a risk factor, or at least it portends that you could get some of the bad consequences of scleroderma. And these vinculins are very high in those patients. But the point is, it's on the spectrum, and that these antivinculin antibodies, when they're super high, look, I have a patient right now who she had IBS. I probably saw her in the year 2000. I didn't have a vinculin test. We treated her, she was doing well. And then she started getting very autoimmune, and we were treating her as an autoimmune disease. Her rheumatologist in San Francisco was treating her, and every time she got treated as an autoimmune disease, things got better. She then started to get more intestinal pseudo-obstruction. And then I did the antibody to vinculin, and it's super high. I think she has scleroderma now. So she started as IBS. Her vinculin could have been high all along. And now 20 years later of me seeing her, she's now got what looks like scleroderma developing. So that's an example of how this antibody could be important even for the long run. And so whoever asked the question obviously has done a little homework on this. So we're very excited about these markers because they're going to help patients.
Fantastic. Okay, more gallbladder questions. Would you recommend, let's see. There's pain in the gallbladder. So there's like people who have stones and sludge. There are people who have no gallbladder. And there are people who feel like they have low bile. And they're just trying to figure out how that impacts SIBO and IBS. What would you say to someone who has gallbladder concerns?
So no gallbladder can lead to spillage of bile into the intestinal tract. So the reason bile diarrhea is a well-known factor that can happen in some patients. And bile diarrhea is essentially bile reaching bacteria converting that bile into toxic bile acids that then irritate your lining and cause diarrhea. Now, if you have bacterial overgrowth, the bile is going to see the bacteria sooner than waiting till it gets to the colon. So you're going to get a more pronounced effect. So bile acid diarrhea, and somebody who has no gallbladder where bile is just dripping all day, you're going to have more pronounced bile diarrhea. The problem with bile diarrhea is how to treat it, because if you take like sequestering agents like Questran or cholestyramine is the generic name, then you're sopping up bile acids, but it's very bloating, those products. So it could make your overgrowth symptoms more pronounced, even though it's working very well to get the bile acids. So bile makes the condition and the situation very complicated. But I will say that if you treat the overgrowth, there's less bile interacting with bacteria, and it will lessen even bile acid diarrhea to some extent. So I think it's a combination. It's a more tricky circumstance to treat those patients.
What about parasites? We hear a lot in this group about, we don't hear enough about it, but a lot of people have parasites or are suspicious of parasites or have never even considered parasites. They've tried all these other things. It never works. I've had other physicians come on and say, until you clear the parasites, nothing will work really to clear your SIBO. What's your opinion about that?
So it's what's interesting, and I'll just give one anecdote and then I'll move over to the specific question, is that there are studies that show post Giardia you can develop IBS. Giardia has very high levels of vinculin in it, FYI. Doesn't have CDTB, just has vinculin. So if you're killing that, maybe you're exposing yourself to vinculin. So that's an interesting anecdote. But going on to the parasites, Giardia is one of the parasites. I've heard so many different things about parasites because they're hard to identify. You have to do multiple stools. Sometimes you don't pick it up. If the expert is not a true expert, some people send their stool to people who are, for example, experience in Africa where there's so many parasites and they can identify them better than we can here because we just don't see them often enough. So there's so many complexities of parasites that make it very challenging. But parasites is a very long story. One of the other problems is blastocystis. Is that a pathogen or not? Some people say if it's there, treat it, and that will help the IBS, but you're giving antibiotics, so you don't know if you're treating overgrowth or you're treating the blastocystis. So it's a little bit mixed up, but there is some data on blastocystis being a mild pathogen in some patients. So if I have a patient that I'm having a hard time treating, I might treat the blastocystis or some of the other parasites that are seen commonly and aren't typically thought of as pathogenic. So it's really patient dependent on how I handle those things, but I don't measure parasites all that often, only when patients don't respond the way I think.
Okay. We have 14 minutes left, you guys, so I'm going to pop around to get as many things covered as possible. A new study indicated a high-risk relationship with lovastatin use in developing ALS or ALS-like symptoms. Are you concerned about that?
So there's some studies that suggest maybe statin use can generate a higher risk for diabetes and other things that are emerging in the literature. So the point is that humans have been dedicated to making the statin get into your bloodstream. And getting the statin into the bloodstream is required in order to reduce cholesterol. SYN-10 is dedicated to absolutely preventing it from getting into the bloodstream. So my hope or anticipation is that there are no consequences of something that just goes out in the stool and doesn't get into your blood, doesn't affect your cholesterol, isn't meant for that. So hopefully none of the things that people are worried about would happen. I understand the person's question. The other part of it is cholesterol lowering is a chronic therapy. You have to take the statin indefinitely to maintain the cholesterol. What we saw in the first trial was 3 months, some of the patients where methane disappeared never came back. That's what I hope happens. I don't know if that will happen, but that's what I hope happens in this trial, is that we drop the methane and it just a new world order occurs and then you're done. Maybe in some patients you do need longer therapy, but again, not absorbed, and maybe it's only short term. Hopefully that will alleviate the person's concerns.
Great. What about this keto diet? Somebody's asking can a high fat diet cause methane SIBO? Oh, and if so, would a keto diet be ill-advised?
So the complication of a keto diet is that you tend to be more acidic because you tend to be ketotic. Mm-hmm. And so acid can fuel methane. But a keto diet also means more constipated, because people tend to get constipated on paleo and keto. So just by the nature of the food being ingested and the style of the diet, so it's hard to know whether it's the methane or just the diet alone that's causing their constipation to be worse while on the keto diet. So I don't have a good answer for it. I've tried the keto diet personally. I think it's pretty interesting and it works for weight loss, at least for what I've, my N-of-1 experience, but it's just very, it's up in the air, because again, the acid could be promoting more methane, but we haven't studied it. I have no data. I can't tell you for sure.
Brett, 12 years ago, he ate a large amount of undercooked beef. He got severe GI problems, high blood pressure, pituitary level hormone problems. He got miraculous temporary relief of all symptoms once after a mega dose of Flagyl, once after a mega of a round of, is it doxycycline?
Doxycycline, yes.
Doxycycline, but I've never been able to duplicate that relief, even with the same antibiotics. Can it occur that some antibiotics will work only once for certain GI tract conditions? Might Xifaxan work more than once for those same conditions? Brett's never tried it. And how can I understand the apparent effectiveness in a single patient of two antibiotics that target different types of bacteria?
So is this Fred? Fred?
No, this is Brett. B-R-E-T-T, Brett.
So Brett's story is something we used to see back a decade ago, before rifaximin, where we would give doxycycline, it would work brilliantly, but then we could never give it again. Mm-hmm. And we actually have a paper that shows how we gave a single antibiotic, neomycin, metronidazole, and they would work brilliantly once, and then try it again, it would never work. Even years later trying it would never work, because the bacteria became resistant to that one exposure. That's how interesting that was. But rifaximin doesn't have that problem. You give it and it works, it almost always works again. I can't say 100%, but 90% of the time it will work again and again and again. And that's why rifaximin has been so beneficial. So could try rifaximin for the IBS or SIBO that they have. But it'd be interesting to see what that person's antibodies are too, because food poisoning started it from some raw meat. That that might be interesting as to why it's tougher to treat for that person. And that's how I would approach it.
I know we were talking about brain fog and SIBO and IBS. Maria is asking about straight up depression and SIBO.
Yeah. So there's a growing bit of information about the relationship between the gut microbiome and psychological issues. In other words, so when I started the talk, I said stress is not the cause, depression is not the cause. But Nick Talley is a very, very prominent, used to be at Mayo Clinic, now is back, and he's, I think, chancellor of a university down in Australia, that's where he's from. But he showed that people get psychological issues after developing IBS, after the microbiome becomes deranged. And there's a very, very prominent investigator in who I know very well in Europe who is studying this. And so certain microbes can lead to depression or other symptoms. So which is why in our reimagined study, as we're getting the juice, we want to know serotonin, we may want to know dopamine, we want to know some of the neurotransmitters that are associated with depression. What bugs are associated with that? So the answer is there is some connection, but we don't fully understand it, but it's being worked on heavily.
Eleanor had a rectal bowel resectioning 20 years ago. Severe IBS resulted, severe bladder infection, was hospitalized for 3 weeks, multiple antibiotics. Is it possible that she had a bowel infection that was undetected?
Could very well be. So one of the things that you can get after a bowel resection or when you're in the hospital and getting antibiotics for post-op recovery is C. diff. Sometimes it passes all on its own. So you go home and you had diarrhea for like a week or two and you're just saying, oh, it'll get better. And it does get better. And that was the trigger. So we do see, I had a patient who had a hysterectomy and she got antibiotics because she got a little wound infection just in the hospital, took the antibiotics for 3 days at home. Everything got better, got a little diarrhea after for about a week and a half. And then ever since then she had IBS. And I think that was probably a little C. diff that came, but it, you know, wasn't that deep and went away by itself. And then, so these are the things that people can have. And all of a sudden that's the triggering event.
Okay. Prokinetics. Here we go. Oh, Michael, we've covered what other prokinetics Dr. Pimentel likes or, you know, works with in his other masterclass. Let's see. Susan, how long should a SIBO patient take prokinetics and can it be lifelong? That's a great question. They're all great, don't get me wrong. But
so can you ask it again?
Sure. How long should a SIBO patient take a prokinetic and can it be lifelong?
Okay, so the prokinetic is sort of an important part of the treatment, especially if they're relapsing frequently enough. And I have patients who've been on, for example, the weakest of the prokinetics, which is erythromycin at a very low dose. And I've had them on that for more than a decade. And that works for them and it's great. But if they stop it, then all of a sudden things relapse. But I try to get them off because my goal is to try and keep people as normal as possible. And hopefully over 6 months, 3 to 6 months, we try and wean and then we see what happens. Because look, back in the day when we didn't use prokinetics, you give an antibiotic, the patient did great. Some people didn't relapse for 2 years with nothing. Some people relapse at 2 or 3 months. So I'm trying not to give everybody prokinetics, but certainly those that relapse, they're going to need something because otherwise we're giving antibiotics over and over, and I'd rather use the prokinetic instead.
And so what's your sign of relapse? Are you retesting after the round of antibiotics?
So generally speaking, if a patient comes in and they feel great, they took a breath test positive, treat, breath test could be negative, they're great. If they relapse the first time, I might do a breath test just to prove that the relapse is really bacterial overgrowth. And then I don't need breath tests after that too much because the patient knows, they know what the relapse feel like, the breath tests have correlated, and so I just generally try and treat it. They don't respond, let's say it's 3 years later and we've been doing this routine, and they have diarrhea and it's a little different and it's a little odd and it's not the same, then I'll bring them in and we'll talk through it to make sure it's the same thing, and we'll do a breath test again.
Okay. I'm sorry I'm not responding because I'm reading to get in the last 4 minutes. Pat. Pat, he has answered your question about the risk of neomycin and metronidazole in the last masterclass, which you have in your portal, my friend. Let me, and that also goes for Anon. I don't know if that's you. And Pat sent that again. Okay. Any suggestions on how to get rifaximin in a less expensive form? Like, as in, how do you get it in a less expensively, I think is the right way of saying it. Any suggestions?
So rifaximin less expensively.
Yeah.
So over the last 2 or 3 years, insurances have learned that rifaximin is, I think this is why, they've learned that rifaximin is costing less and less because they're saving on the flip side on colonoscopies and other things. So insurance companies have been leaning towards paying larger and larger proportion of the bill for rifaximin. However, I do understand that in some cases that's not the case. 98% of rifaximin is covered to some extent by insurance, which, boy, 2 years ago, 3 years ago, that was not the case either. I have no control on drug companies' charges, and so I can't.
Have you heard of coupons? I've heard of coupons.
Oh, so there are coupons you can get. You can call the company, Salix Pharmaceuticals, see if you can get some coupons, or your doctor can, and that eliminates the copay for some patients, depending upon your insurance. So there are ways to get it less expensive for yourself. So that's a way.
Okay. Is IBS Smart Test available in Canada?
So according to what I heard, in the coming weeks, it will be. The answer is yes.
Yes. Monique and Kelly, the question about migrating motor complex is taking supplements. He's already answered this in a previous masterclass. Do you want to just address that really quickly, Dr. Pimentel?
Say that again.
If you're trying to rest your migrating motor complex for that like 4 to 5 hour window.
Yep.
Brushing your teeth, herbal tea, and is wine the same as food? Alex.
Okay, wine is the same as food. Yeah, but generally I say water. I'm okay with some coffee. I'm okay with some non-caloric herbal tea. That should be okay. But anything with calories in it are going to cause trouble. And I don't mean, don't put sweetener in it. That's, even though that's a zero calorie sweetener, the receptors of your body think it's food, even though they can't absorb it. So I wouldn't use sweeteners in your tea. I hope that answers their question.
It does. When it comes to leaky gut, huge topic to wrap up on here. We have 1 minute. But are you an L-glutamine guy? Do you try to help everybody with their leaky gut, or you just focus on if you clear your SIBO, chances are your leaky gut's going to get?
Well, there's actually a study that shows if you clear SIBO, leaky gut gets better. That's new. That's not our work, but others. So I'm really excited about that. The other part is vinculin is part of the adhesion molecule complex. Vinculin impaired, your cells don't connect well. So it's possible that leaky gut and vinculin are related. We're working on exploring that question further to get you more data. So stay tuned for some more information on that one.
Christina's asking, can you get methane in the stomach? I think she's got some belching and gas issues. What would you say?
So methane slows the transit down of the small bowel and the colon, probably the stomach as well. But I don't think the methanogens are in the stomach. I think what's happening is the whole small bowel is slowed down to a point where the stomach is affected and you get more belching. So yes, it's probably related. And I'm sorry to hear that. In fact, in our, we did a factor analysis of methane versus hydrogen. And one of the things, belching can sometimes be associated with methane because of, we think, this reason.
Oh, very interesting. Dr. Pimentel, to honor our agreement of a heart out at the time we agreed to, I want to say thank you very, very much. Everyone, please chime in the Q&A box with gratitude for this incredible SIBO hero. Dr. Pimentel, if you do have the email address for anyone who wants to apply for the study? If not, you can email it to me and I'll put it in the portal, you guys.
No, what I'll give you is a telephone number to our research office, and please don't inundate, but 310-423-7302, and they'll pass you on to the right personnel.
Warn them. You're going to have to warn them.
I will warn them.
Yeah, you're going to have to warn them. I have the phone number. I'll put it in the chat in a minute, everyone. Thank you so much, sir. We will see you in June with DDW updates. Looking forward to it. And I'll also see you in Portland at the SIBO Symposium in a couple of weeks.
Perfect.
Thanks, everybody.
Thank you,
Dr. Pimentel. Bye. Have a great day. Woohoo! Our hero. I'm going to stay on. Dr. Pimentel, have a great day. Karen is here. Bye, dear. Thanks.
Bye. Great job, guys.
Bye. Great job. Amazing. So many people are saying they have hope. I feel that way. I hope you do too. I just want you to know, if I didn't get your question, I worked really hard to cover as many as possible. We got to 99% of them. My heart goes out to you if I didn't, and I know what that feels like, but I am trying really hard to get to as many as possible. Let me put the phone number in the chat. We do send your comments, by the way, to Dr. Pimentel. Thanks, Pat. So you guys can, you know, we like to share the love with our speakers because it's a lot of work. Thanks everyone for coming. 7302. Okay, that's the phone number. I just put it in the chat. Hey, Manette. Manette, glad you loved it. Steve, thank you very much for being constant companion on this journey. I also wanted to mention that if you do want to participate in the 10-pack for the masterclasses for 2019, you do have included that access to the Q&A with Dr. Pimentel on June 7th. And the masterclasses come down to $19.80 per class from $59. So you'd buy the $198 and you would get Jason Harlax. It's already happened, which was amazing. You get the recording. So that's something, please, if that is interesting to you, please do sign up for that. It was in the email we sent. Go to SIBOSOS.com. It's there. Email Karen at info@SIBOSOS. She will hook you up. If you bought this thing for $59 and you want to upgrade, we will honor that. And then also, our next class is someone you probably never heard of before. Her name is Dr. Ann Hill, and she is out of Portland, Oregon. I was introduced to her by Dr. Tom Messenger, who a lot of you know and love, and Dr. Allison Seebecker. And she's going to be talking about gut infections and parasites in this next masterclass that's coming up. And we already have the class recorded, and we already have the PowerPoint, which, by the way, you guys, Dr. Pimentel said we could not get a PowerPoint from him. So I don't know if he temporarily forgot that when he was talking, or if he might be like, oh, sure, I can do that. I don't know. I know, Martina, I didn't get to yours, but I'm going to try to figure out an answer for you on your question, Martina. So if he will let us have the PowerPoint, I will ask him again. I think it's a legal issue with Cedars-Sinai. So I'll work on that. Just know that it'll be in the portal as soon as possible if it's available, but I don't think we're getting it. I think he was just kind of forgetting that in that moment. Maybe. But Dr. Ann Hill is going to be on April 7th. Okay, this is the woman that Dr. Seebecker was in a conference and walked out of the conference to text me in the hall to go, oh my gosh, you need to get Dr. Ann Hill for a masterclass. Talk later. And then went back inside. So just to give you an example of how enthusiastic she was and how much very special information she had. So it's something for you to consider. And do know that we are working on a 9-hour docuseries on IBS, SIBO, and leaky gut. So we'll send out some save the date type announcements. I'm very excited. The first part of the talk will not be recorded. I missed the whole first. No. Lisa, it's recorded. I don't know what you mean by your question. Sorry, all recorded. There were master classes that we did late last year. In your portal, you will have them, because I gifted that to everybody who signed up for this class, because I want you to have as much comprehensive, cohesive information. So you'll see what he was saying last year, and you'll see how he's revealed even more information, and then hopefully even more information in June. Yeah, you will get all of the recordings. Yep, okay, Muriel's taking care of that. What else can we talk about? Martina, I'm gonna work on yours. A lot of people were asking questions that have already been covered in those previous recordings. And somebody was asking if SIBO was a lifelong condition. Honestly, it is and it isn't. It depends on your underlying cause. So that's just a new way of thinking about it if you haven't been thinking about it that way. If some people will have luck with rifaximin and neomycin or just rifaximin. If you have diverticulitis, if you have those blind loops, if you that's like twists in your intestine or like that sling Dr. Pimentel was talking about, it might be lifelong. So just for clarification, it's more than just take the, there are more underlying causes. So I want to say this. Dr. Allison Seebecker, if you were not here for this at the end of last year, she did a class on underlying causes. If you do not know your underlying cause, please go to SIBOSOS.com. And it's $59. It's going to be the best $59 you've spent. I really work hard to keep these recordings and these classes very inexpensive. It costs a fortune to do this. Not your problem, but I'm just saying. Watch her class. Because if you don't know why you have SIBO, or if you're like, I don't think I ever have had food poisoning, this class was incredible. Like, it was her Sistine Chapel. So it's called the Underlying Causes Masterclass with Dr. Allison Seebecker. And our website is SIBOSOS.com. It's been renovated. It's so pretty. And of course, Karen's always there for you to help get you information and hook you up with the right links. If you're not in the Facebook group yet, that's also about to be 8,000 people strong. I saw the other day someone asked a question, 60 people responded, and they were great answers. This is such an educated, compassionate group. So this, I think it's the SIBO SOS, I think it's Virtual Summit Facebook group. You have to, I don't want to say apply, but or it's SIBO SOS community. Thank you, Mariel. So you just go in there and introduce yourself or just go. You'll be like, oh, have you, I don't know. There are two questions to kind of weed out people. And they're very simple. They're like, I don't even remember what they are. They're so basic. And we'll accept. And then you can pop in there. And it's very, even if you just sort of stalk it and don't even ever type anything, that's fine. There's a lot of good information there. Okay. Oh, great, Lisa. I'm so pleased. Thank you, everybody. Does anyone else have any other questions? Okay, Rachna, don't worry. I gotcha. And email to Karen. Hang on, Rachna. Eleanor, go ahead and do that. Good, B. I'm glad you're enjoying the work. Julie, yay, we'll pass that on. Kay, good to have you here. And yes, hope is essential, because that's one of the things. I don't want you to just have information. I want you to have inspiration as well, because I have a lot of good information, but if I don't have the inspiration, a lot of times I don't act on the information I know. So I wanted to just let you know that's kind of part of my whole philosophy and the team's philosophy is to give you information and inspiration. Yay, Lore, Diane, yay, Gayla, Denise, hugs and kisses, you guys. Dr. Pimentel does address being underweight in the previous masterclass, so I didn't ask him again today, but he has addressed that before. Do you have to be on Facebook to join the Facebook group? You do. But you can use somebody else, not somebody else's name, but you don't have to use your own name. Think about that. You can use John Smith. It doesn't matter. There are definitely privacy settings that you can use so that you don't have to have a huge privacy, vulnerability. It's not perfect. It's the internet. It's what it is. It's great until it's not. So just putting that out there, I do want to invite you to it, though. I know that we would love to have you there. Okay, Karen is just sending me a little quick text. And, Karen's also reminding me. Good one, Karen. Thanks, Carlene. We are bolstering up our YouTube channel. So you don't have to be a member of the Facebook group to see some of the Facebook lives and videos that we post in the Facebook group. So when we do Facebook lives, and I do at least once a month with one of these thought leaders, we are then putting it into the YouTube channel. I just, thanks for reminding me about that, Karen, because we know not everybody is on Facebook. You don't get the community of like chit chat and like, hey, I just tried this protein powder. Does anyone have a better protein powder? And then like 60 people respond. You don't get that, but at least you can see some of the Facebook lives that we do. And we usually do a Facebook live with each of our speakers. So you can kind of get a taste of what the class would be like. Ann Hill is going to be doing one with us. We usually announce it in an email in advance. So we have Megan Taylor coming. We have Dr. Steven Sandberg Lewis. I've seen their class notes. Oh my gosh, they're so good. And if you feel like this is all like over your head, then go and get the SIBO Solved course at SIBO SOS. Pick up on Dr. Seebecker's masterclass on diet, treatment and prevention, and underlying causes I talked about already, and Prokinetics. She did an amazing class on Prokinetics as well. The name of the YouTube channel is SIBO SOS. I'm going to let my team answer that because I don't know if there's an underscore. I think it's just, if you type in SIBO SOS, I think you'll find it. Okay. We'll see you guys soon. Thank you so much. Ranjana, will you do me a favor and email me at info@sibosos.com, and Karen and I will get you. Chat. So in the chat, oh, there you go. You're the best, Karen and Mariel. In the chat is the Facebook group and is the, hey, Martina. Let's see. I know we did not get to the histamine question. If you're really interested in histamine questions, please look at, well, I think you already emailed us, Pat, and that you are already a patient of Dr. Lenny Weinstock. If you're not, that masterclass with him, that was a life changer. Since he put up the slide, the histamine is one of the things he is studying. Thank you, Rachel. I appreciate that. Yep. Okay, do we have the YouTube channel in there? Did I miss it? This is fun. It's good to talk to you guys. It's in the chat, yes. Okay, I just don't see it. Lisa, he has addressed losing weight with methane, like a diet recommendation. Honestly, it wasn't like a life changer. The methane does tend to eat more calories, and that's part of the problem. Like the methane literally absorbs more of the calories of the food you eat, which is one of the reasons why it tends to be something that does cause some people to gain weight. There wasn't like a do this kind of answer. Definitely, Pat, I want Dr. Pimentel to study histamines too. But if you need answers, Dr. Weinstock's class, also at SIBOSOS.com. That changed my life. That all this has changed my life, obviously. I'm right here with you in it. I know it's been an intense couple of hours. If this is your first masterclass, thank you for being here. Welcome. If this is your multiple masterclass with us here at SIBO SOS, you know, this is what keeps me going, is these afternoons, these days where we get to really connect and get answers together. And this is what turns me on. That's all there is to it. This is what stokes the fires of my enthusiasm. I didn't have this information. I want you to have this information. In 2015, I got that false diagnosis and had it false diagnosis for 18 months. I'm getting the timeline a little bit messed up. It doesn't matter. You get the idea. I was so lost. Remember, I've probably had SIBO since I was 5. So the fact that you guys are here just makes me feel like mission accomplished and makes me so, so happy. Pat, time for a nap. Amazing your energy and enthusiasm, but I'm telling you, this is what turns me on. Like, I do a lot of other things in this lifetime. I have an amazing career, but you want to know what really, really gets me going. And if anybody, Karen and I started Siobhan's Yoga Studio back in the 90s together. And it's that same level of enthusiasm I have for you guys in these projects. So just if you weren't here, we wouldn't be here. So thank you so much. Doris, we're glad you made it into class under the wire right before we started. I noticed you signed in. So great to have you. All right, I'm going to wrap it up. Everybody, go to SIBOSOS.com. Get more information there. You can see all of the masterclasses we've done since last year. And if you are new, please check out Dr. C. Becker's classes. They are phenomenal. And they will, a lot of the questions that we were getting were, I could tell they had not taken Dr. C. Becker's classes on diet, treatment and prevention, prokinetics, and underlying causes. This was amazing, obviously, and so hopeful. But I'm just saying that if you only do one other thing with us, get a hold of those masterclasses from Dr. C. Becker, and you will know more than your doctor, unless Dr. Pimentel or these speakers are your doctors. So it's diet, treatment and prevention, prokinetics, underlying causes. They're so good. They're long. They're good. Just take your time. Breathe. Know, we know that this is intense. Rika, good for you. Got an appointment at Cedars-Sinai. That's awesome. Okay, I'm going to sign off. Thanks, everybody. We'll see you soon. Always find us at info@SIBOSOS.com if you need us. Karen is my best friend and a realtor. Oh, she's like this amazing, powerhouse businesswoman who also takes on this mission with love in her heart and doesn't really need to be doing this, but she does it because she cares about you too. So thanks. Hey, Jen. Okay. Thanks, Karen.
Bye. Have a great day, guys.
Thanks, everybody. Remember, there is hope. Don't give up. Talk to you later.